Hey, this is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is this week's Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of September 30th, here are some top stories. More than half of Americans over the age of 65 have a chronic condition. Think diabetes, cancer, or Alzheimer's disease. So imagine someone coming into an emergency department with multiple conditions. It happens, and the experience for both patient and provider can be challenging. But as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, some emergency departments are changing the way they're doing business.
We're coming to a facility with a 65-year-old male. In a memory care area.
Calls like that aren't unusual here at Banner University Medical Center in Phoenix. Staff here see more than 1,000 patients a month who are 65 and older. Nationally, emergency departments, or EDs, are treating seniors at higher rates than non-seniors, according to the American College of Emergency Physicians. But what makes this place different is that it's the only accredited geriatric ED in the entire state.
We know that older adults, when they come into the ED, they have more complications. And there was a need for improving the care of these patients when they come to the emergency department.
Dr. Nimit Agarwal is a chief of geriatrics at Banner University Medical Center. Last November, Agarwal and his colleagues started the accreditation process with the Geriatric Emergency Department Accreditation Program.
So we had to show that we were doing some initiatives. One of our biggest initiative in the ED is fall prevention in older adults.
But tackling something like falls, which is the leading cause of injury-related deaths among older adults, according to the CDC, means taking an interdisciplinary approach.
We have nurses who are specially trained for detection of falls. We have a pharmacist who looks at their medications. We have the physicians who get training every month on what geriatrics-focused care could be.
So this probably sounds like what should be happening in every ED, but geriatric EDs and geriatricians themselves are in short supply. The Arizona Geriatric Society says the state should have more than 500 geriatricians. But as of 2016, there were only 117. And the need is only going to grow as baby boomers age. Julie Kobos is a nursing director for Emergency Department Observation and Trauma at Banner. She takes me on a tour of their geriatric ED. So there's not a separate ward for older patients, though that's the goal. Rather, there are six age-friendly rooms. She points to a room with an age-friendly sign on the sliding glass door.
It's a 68-year-old patient, and so the sign is on the door. It's been explained to the patient as to if there's any needs that need to be met, we're here to attend to them.
Like providing extra pillows and blankets, non-slip socks. But I asked Kobos, can't anyone who's in the ED get an extra pillow or chair?
Because yes, you can get pillows, non-slip socks, blankets all day long in every emergency department.
What's different here is the level of care, the details. Like, what if a patient forgets their hearing aids?
We have hearing devices. These things are fabulous. I've already had great feedback from our age-friendly community where this has assisted them in hearing what's being explained to them, tests that are being done, discharge instructions that are given. We have magnifiers in there if they're having problems seeing, they forgot their glasses or what have you. Earplugs in case it gets too loud or noisy.
All of that is music to Phoenix Fire Captain Benjamin Santillan's ears. Santillan is a national certified dementia trainer. He says first responders are increasingly responding to calls involving people with Alzheimer's disease. So Phoenix Fire is training its people to care for this population. But what happens when they arrive at the ED?
Some of the common mistakes that are made by medical personnel is they get hands on the patient and they start touching them and they want to put the blood pressure cuff on, they want to put the pulse oximetry probe on.
And that can cause them to get more confused, more combative.
That's Dr. Agarwal again.
Having a staff which knows the TADAs, which is T-A-D-A, it's a mnemonic that stands for tolerate, anticipate, do not agitate.
Something else they do? Hire nurses who have experience working at assisted living facilities. Earlier, Julie Kobos told me a story about one of her nurses and a 78-year-old patient with Alzheimer's disease.
Bless her heart, she was very scared. She was very confused, doing a lot of yelling in the room. The nurses kept trying to comfort her. So my charge nurse did a really cool thing.
That nurse was Brandy Cano.
This little lady kept wandering everywhere, and she was pretty quick on her feet. We thought she was going to escape. So I had her sit by me. She ate lunch. And
she settled down. That small gesture changed everything, and sometimes that's all it takes, human connection. There are about 100 hospitals across the country that are an accredited geriatric ED, but with an estimated 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 every single day, the numbers just don't add up yet. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From the Education Desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
Governor Doug Ducey had sharp words for the judge who ruled the governor's plan to take money out of the state land trust for education without first getting congressional approval was illegal.
Judge Wake puts on a robe in the morning and thinks he's God, but he's not. I want to tell you what everyone down at the courthouse needs to know. It's time for Judge Wake to retire.
The governor went on to call the judge an embarrassment to the legal community and predicted his ruling would be overturned on appeal. But many in Arizona's education community are focusing on what happens next. The money that has been disbursed and is scheduled to be over the next 5 to 6 years appears to be safe, but there seem to be questions about what happens after that. With me to talk about that is Rebecca Gao, Executive Director of Stanford Children Arizona. And Rebecca, first off, let me ask for your initial reaction to the ruling.
Well, I think it's mildly interesting. I think what's more interesting is the way he wrote it. And like when folks have been talking about it in the last 24 hours, it's more about his word choice than actually what he was saying. So in the short term, it's really not a big deal.
So you're not concerned at all about the money from 123 that has been dispersed to districts and that will be for the next couple of years. You think that's safe?
I do think that's safe. I'm not worried about it.
Are there others who are concerned about it? Like in the education world, is anybody worried about the impacts of this ruling in the immediate future?
Not anymore. I think the initial 30 seconds after it was released, there was a gasp. And then as folks read more closely and attorneys weighed in very, very quickly, and I had assurance from a very good attorney yesterday, it's not going to affect anything. And that got transmitted to the education community, at least the leadership level that I work at. By the afternoon, everybody was calm that it's fine. It's not going to hurt the funding through 2026. But we always knew there was going to be a cliff at that point. And the question now is, what do we do about it?
So let me ask you about that question that you raised. What do you take from this ruling about what the state can or maybe needs to be doing about education funding going forward?
Well, I think it means two things. First of all, it means that if we want to use that mechanism again, clearly we need to get congressional approval first. But I think the more important thing is what we do about education funding in the big picture right now. There is a large, loud call from the education community that we need a long-term, sustainable, significant funding source for education. And if we can start right now with a series of bumps up over the next few years, legislative cycles, election cycles, hopefully we'll be at a place at that point where we've replenished what schools need. So hopefully by 2025 or 26, we'll have met a lot of those needs if we do the right thing now.
Is that preferable to you and to others who are in the field of education in Arizona that we do other things so that we don't have to try to do another Prop 123 kind of thing in 5 or 6 years?
I think so. And I don't think it's just about the state land trust issue. I think that caused some problems. You know, in terms of the election, it won by a pretty narrow margin.
Yeah, not by much.
So I think there's a broader concern that it might not pass again. So I think it would be much preferable to have some legislative actions, to have a secure, dedicated funding source to address issues within our tax code that impact education that are out of whack. Those things need to all be happening now so that by the time 2025 rolls around, we don't need to worry about the state land trust.
Have you gotten a sense that having Judge Wake's ruling and to some extent maybe even the language he used in that ruling, is that maybe giving a little extra push to folks to try to figure something out, knowing that it might be a bit more challenging next time around to use the same mechanism? Mm-hmm.
Perhaps. I don't know that a lot of us in the broader education alphabet community, all the organizations, you know, not typical parents, but I think the teachers, the school administrators, the foundations that support us, everyone is very, very aware of the deficiencies that exist right now and the need to find significant funding. There are serious issues that a lot of people at a certain level are very focused on.
There had been so much talk after last year's election when the Invest in Ed initiative was removed from the ballot about the need to ask voters to do something to raise revenue. Is that still the thinking in the education community, that there will be some kind of ballot measure on the ballot next year to raise taxes, raise revenue in some capacity?
I think there is a very, very good chance. Everybody's talking and researching and listening, and the fact is nothing significant happened last session, and that's very frustrating. We had an election last year that was all about education, even though Invest in Ed was removed from the ballot. And we started the session with promises from legislators on both sides of the aisles that they would address this. And nothing really got done. We had a surplus in the rainy day fund that was an opportunity to catch schools up a little bit. Instead, it got used for different things. And so that created more momentum. And everyone still sees a vacuum. Nothing changed from August last year when it was kicked off the ballot. So, yes, a lot of folks want to see something done. If the legislature can get it done this session, great. But we need to be prepared in case that doesn't happen.
All right, that's Rebecca Gao, Executive Director of Stand for Children Arizona. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, which airs weekdays from 9 to 11, here's co-host Steve Goldstein.
The film Avengers Endgame passed Avatar earlier this year to become the highest-grossing movie of all time with nearly $3 billion in sales. Four of the top 10 films had their direct origins in the comic book world, and with that genre creating as close to a financial guarantee as studios can get, we'll be seeing more characters making the leap from page to screen. But as the better-known characters like Batman and Spider-Man are already part of the two biggest comic companies, DC and Marvel, producers are looking for other options. Image Comics is often where they're turning. The Valley's Todd McFarlane, who also owns a huge toy company and has spent millions on some of the most well-known baseball cards, is the co-founder of Image. His creation, Spawn, just became a Guinness record holder when its 301st issue was published last month. And McFarlane is working on turning Spawn into a major motion picture that he would direct, and he's with me to talk about all of that. Todd, we've seen so many comic book characters end up on the big screen. Are we going to see more lesser-known characters because of a need for Hollywood to find new products?
Steve, they have no choice. So let's deal with the reality of what's happening out in the world. Marvel Comic Books and DC Comics, the two biggest companies out there to do comic books. I co-own Image, which is number three, but let's talk about the two big boys because they own a dramatic amount of the market share. They are owned by, Marvel's owned by Disney, and DC's owned by Warner Brothers. So all their versions of their companies and subsidiaries are going to get to be able to play with those characters. Everybody else is locked out. So what you're seeing right now is Sony, Universal, Paramount, Fox, Lionsgate, all the streamers, plus all the cable, plus ABC, NBC, CBS. Like, a lot of these companies now go, we're locked out. And so we have no choice but to go and look at characters that are, for lack of a better word, obscure. And so I think you're going to see more of it because they're never going to get their hands on the material otherwise. So our company, which is number three, we put out about 70 books. 23 of our books have now been optioned into Hollywood. You know, our big hit from a few years ago was The Walking Dead. My mm-hmm. partner created The Walking Dead. They're calling constantly for these characters that have sales that will not withhold an audience on TV or movies. So they're going to have to just say, do we like the concept? Mm-hmm. And will this concept resonate either on a national and or global level so that we can actually make this thing work?
Quality control, where does that come for you in terms of that matches the original product with what people see on screen?
I think it's a difficult balance. Here's why. Because if somebody's going to spend $150 million, and some of these movies are $200 million, I mean, The Avengers was $300 million. and you've got that much money sunk into it, you have all this data, I assume, these are big billion-dollar corporations, that they think they know what buttons need to get pushed for it to work, for them to basically get their investment back. Let's just get clinical, right? They've got $200 million in. They need to get $200 million out. They want to be in control of those decisions as much as possible, and they're not overly concerned about pandering to the fans that might generate out of that $350 million, might only generate $25 million of it. They have to say, we got to think bigger than this and think about it as a movie. And I do the same. Look, I do comics and toys and movies and novels, whatever. And whenever I'm doing one of those medium, I don't let the other pieces dictate to it. So Spawn movie, we're trying to get it off the ground. I've written it, and part of the process is I'm going to direct it. I own a toy company, I have for 25 plus years. I had to gather my salespeople to say, just so you know, because they were super excited, oh my gosh, Todd, the movie's, you know, starting to come together. I go, there's nothing in the movie that we'll be able to sell a toy about. And you should have seen the look on their face. They went, whoa, what did you just say? My salespeople go, Todd, you own this toy company, and you're making a movie in which we can't sell toys. Exactly. Because it wasn't Todd, the CEO of the toy company, that was basically coming up with the idea of the movie. It was Todd, the entrepreneur entertainment person, who needs to make a good movie.
So huge milestone in the Spawn creation now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hate to ask a traditional question. I'm a non-traditional guy. But when you went through all that you went through working for the big dogs and then decided, that's it, I've had enough, I'm going to go do it, have you exceeded your wildest dreams, or you're not quite there yet?
The milestone isn't a milestone. Milestones mean that you're, and there are, but here's the milestone. Issue 301 of Spawn will be the longest running creator-owned comic book in the history of mankind and mankind ever. The big boys were Marvel and DC Comics, who I worked for. I did some Batman and Hulk, and Spider-Man is really the one that put me over the top when I sort of did a creative reinvention of some of the things that are on the paper that they still use today in the comics and the movies, of which, while I was doing it, they said to stop, don't do it, every single time I did it. So it was a constant battle, which basically was the reason that I ended up leaving. Looking at your own legacy, it is hard for me to look at. Life is just a marathon, right? And if you're running, and if your life is 26 miles, which is a marathon, I don't know that at mile 21, 22, you think about mile 8. It's just part of the journey, right? I'm a complete forward thinker. I'll let other people add the nice words or the nasty words or whatever. I you can do an article about me that makes me a saint or a sinner. I don't really worry about the past. If I stop and pause and think about it, then I go, we've run a pretty good race so far, right? I mean, it's not bad. Yes. I don't think anybody that has even a little bit of celebrity success is really analyzing their life. They're just doing it. I mean, they're in the middle of the act. Mm-hmm. And it's usually only when you do, like, interviews where you feel like you're at the psychiatrist's office and you're on the couch and they're going, what makes you so determined? You don't really think about yourself any more than you, Steve, get up and go, what makes me a great radio personality? Yeah, you just go and you just do. Do I have a few words of wisdom along the way as I get older? Yes, but it's usually based on the failures. As I find where the failures are, I try to prevent others from going there.
Well, Todd, finally, one thing you don't expect to be a zero X is this motion picture you want to direct, a version of your creation, Spawn, that you created decades ago in the comics. So you want to go forward, you've met with Hollywood, and you're telling Hollywood that this can only be made with the script that you've written and the script that you are going to direct. But you've never directed a motion picture before, let alone a major motion picture. So are you nervous at all about this? If this were to come to fruition, are you freaking out?
No. Next question. Todd, should you be? Of course. What human being would? But I'm not. So this is the bizarreness of me, right? I have directed mentally in my mind this movie 1,000 times that I actually just have no fear of it, right? Even though from the outside looking in, it's like your first time director. Why would they let you do this? I don't know why, but that's the negotiation, because they're never going to make it, because that's the non-negotiable. I write, produce, direct. That's the non-negotiable. Are they going to give me a $100 million budget? Of course not. So I wrote a $20 million budget movie. So because why? They'll go get a 22-year-old young upstart director. I want to be the young upstart. I'm just not young. Take that off. And I'll just be that guy that comes in there. I won't be an indecisive director, number one. I'll make decisions, good, better, and different, based on the input of, and this is the second part, and the biggest key part, hire the best people you can with the most experience that you trust around you, and they will make you look good every single time. It's doable. Here's why we know, ladies and gentlemen. If any of you saw this movie recently called A Star is Born, that was directed by Bradley Cooper, the actor. And if you look at that movie, it is professional on every scale. Why? Because Bradley Cooper did exactly what I just said. He went and got the pros, and the pros made sure that that movie didn't look like a first-time director. It's, you can do it.
All right, that is Todd McFarlane. He is creator of Spawn, multi-record holder, as we're talking about the comics that he has created and also been involved with when it comes to sales and creation and everything else. Very lucky to have him in the Valley. Todd, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
From the Business Desk, here's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger.
Today, we are kicking off a series of conversations with community leaders on important topics of the moment. First up, recent campaigns from Dior, Barbie, and Cadbury, among others, have led to backlash for what many see as cultural appropriation. A Dia de los Muertos Barbie was released to the market. Cadbury unveiled a Unity bar made of four variations of chocolate, each segregated by color. And perhaps the most highly criticized, Dior embarked on a questionable marketing campaign for a fragrance it dubbed Sauvage. That campaign featured Native American imagery centered around actor Johnny Depp, choices the company defended by explaining it had consulted with the nonprofit Americans for Indian Opportunity. Arizona designer Lauren Aragon and Iya Afo, a spiritual leader and historic trauma expert, joined us to talk about why these campaigns continue to be so painful for communities. But the fact is, these issues keep coming up. So I wanted to start with the obvious first question. How is this still happening? And in much the same way, over and over again.
I'm still like, really? Not again. This might always my reaction when I see something pop up like this again. And it's still difficult to really try to grasp why designers or just anyone outside of the Native American community continues to try to implement these things that, I guess, try to project what they believe the Native American culture is. And what hurts is that there's really no true representation by Native American communities to do that. And that's just talking Native American communities. And there's obviously other things, other communities, other cultures that are misappropriated, misrepresented. And I always ask myself, you know, where are the Native American authorities or people that are in this community or in these industries to speak to this, to say something to this? In the fashion world, it's me. I mean, I'm the fashion designer. I need to be that person to be responsible to say something to that, or at least educate people more about why this is wrong, why we always have an argument about this as not being correct, or how we're misused or misrepresented. And really, I think Native American community and us as Native designers, and there's quite a few of us, we need to step up and start to educate people and tell people why these things are not right and show what we can show and be more open to discuss those things and share our ideas. And we need to be more respectful of that ourselves and tell people why we need to be.
And so that's a lot of what you do in your work, Lauren, is pushing back against this kind of thing by being the person to do it yourself.
Yes.
Iya, what's your reaction?
You know, I feel like I'm still at a place where I'm hopeful that education changes people's behavior. I just think people don't get it. I don't always feel like it's about hate or it's about intentional disrespect. I feel like we just have to keep educating and talking about it so that people understand what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and why it's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. The other part of it, I think, is those of us that are indigenous, and I use the word indigenous in terms of Native American, African American, you know, somebody that is indigenous to a specific land. Mm-hmm. So those of us that are indigenous are so hungry to have opportunity and so hungry to finally be included in something that we're often willing to overlook things that are disrespectful and that don't fit with what we should be doing moving forward.
Companies or their defenders often will say, like, you know,
well, so-and-so said this was okay, so I thought, like, it was okay, right? Like, and this happened in this Dior example, right? The Cologne campaign was created in partnership with Americans for Indian Opportunity, this group. Is that enough? Is that anything?
So for this situation, I think it's multi-layered. I think, number one, Johnny Depp has a personal relationship with the person that's the head of that organization. Number two, I believe that as Indigenous people, because we have not been included, because we have not had opportunity, the smallest chance for opportunity, we're running and grabbing at it because we want to be included. We want to have a chance to do it. So we jump in and do it. The third big piece, and for me, this is so, so major, is that when people say Native American, they have one group that they're referring to. There are 573 nationally recognized tribes in the United States. So each one of those tribes, and then there are also tribes and people that are not recognized that are still valid. But each one of those groups have their own culture, have their own traditions, have their own languages, have their own ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. When we talk about African Americans or Africans, we're talking about a continent with 52 countries, with thousands of dialects and thousands of cultures. Right. So there are some of us that are very, as my very dear friend Sunbird says, there's people that are deep in the cultural pond, and there are people that are more shallow in the cultural pond. If you ask an organization or you ask a person that's part of the Native American collective or part of the African American collective, if this is okay or that is okay, if I'm a person that's shallow in the cultural pond, it might not be offensive to me.
Sure.
If I am a Native American person that's deep within the cultural pond and does things in a very traditional way that aligns with my people, it will be highly offensive to me.
Yeah. So, Lauren, let me turn to you. And it becomes really polarized really quickly, I think. And I wonder, how do you explain this to people who say, you know, well, I wasn't offended by this, or it seems fine to me, or they checked with whatever group, so sure. How do you explain to people what the real hurt is there?
It's really an explanation of where you come from and what these items and things that are represented in commercials and shows and movies are represent. Educating them to the extent where, from my knowledge, a lot of these items come from like the Plains Native American groups. And those things are sacred. They do have some meaning, some value. And when you put it out there like that, that just anyone can use it, then it loses its value, its cultural value, and just anybody can have a part of it. But it really, it's something that's earned. A lot of those things, or it's something that's handed down that, you know, it holds significance to things that we believe in. And people just see it for its artistic value a lot of the times. And that's where it ends. I see that even in as a designer, that some people just love my designs because of the patterns that I use. But there's others that want to go deeper. They want to know what those things mean.
And they do mean something.
Yes, they do mean something. And they have some representation to where I come from, and they tell a story, and that's my connection to my work. And again, that's somebody's connection to their culture when you do that. And so it definitely needs to be expressed more. It definitely needs to be shown why those things aren't just to be used. But I think that the other things that kind of really put things in a negative light are over-sexualizing models with Native American regalia. The ultimate example it's always the headdress in a scantily clad woman in bikini. We see these at
Victoria's
concert
Secret
shows.
Fashion show,
yes,
right? Yeah.
Those type of things. So it's absolutely not meant for that.
Yeah, you study trauma, right? And I wonder how that plays into this conversation in your mind.
I think part of the issue also is that in the United States, and in dominant culture, we separate culture from religion. We have the separation of church and state. In indigenous culture, you cannot separate religion and culture, spirituality and culture. They're one and of the same. So when you have that headdress, every feather is chosen for a reason. The color of the feathers have a significance. In any regalia, the fabric that's used to create that particular item has a reason. There, it might be cotton for one reason. It might be cashmere for another reason. There are things that are sewn into it. There are things that it's soaked in. There are herbs that are used with it. So each one of these pieces is a part of the whole. So you can't easily separate, oh, this looks so cool, I want to wear it,
right,
when this is somebody's culture, spirituality, deep meaning. It's like consecrating the cross. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same type of thing, but people don't quite understand that there's significance to each nuance that's put into the regalia, that's put into ceremony, to ritual.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to trauma, we talk about historical trauma, collective trauma, intergenerational trauma. And we're not talking about current racism. We're not talking about oppression. We're talking about a reaction to something that's happened to a group of people. Trauma is passed from one generation to the next through the physical DNA, mm-hmm, number one. And number two, we have what happens environmentally as a result of those previous trauma, right? So what the science and the research shows us is through reconnecting to culture, you help to mitigate the damage of historical trauma that's happened to the collective. So we need these things like the clothing that Lauren designs. We need things like our ceremony, our ritual, our sacred dance that gets depicted in these videos as entertainment, that helps us to heal from what's happened.
So this is really actually hopeful in a way, right? That there are ways in which,
yes,
and what Lauren is doing, right, is
right,
a way of healing, it sounds like.
Yes.
So then my question becomes, in light of this sort of, you know, marketing and consumer-driven world that we live in and the effort by lots of these companies to become more diverse in this way, what are the right ways to do this?
One of the ways I always try to promote is more involvement by Native American communities to be a part of this, or have the people that are outside the communities to connect with the culture. Have some representation. Work with the artists there is one great step to start making this better. I think the AIO really missed the mark in trying to help. And they even admitted it. They didn't talk with the PRs, with Dior, on what this was going to entail, all the details that were going to go into this commercial. And everything that is kind of a negative mark needs to be evaluated. And the first thing that I noticed was the use of the word savage.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, that just continues to dehumanize Native American culture, indigenous culture. When that word was used, it was used negatively against us, and it still is. So even things like that, the word usage, the images that are used, the use in the commercial, the use of the dancer and the woman, it was so cliche. And we need to get away from that. And I think that's, the world thinks that that's all Native American culture is. And everybody just sees that right away, and they think that we're all the same. So when you hear indigenous or Native American, everybody already thinks that it's just another dancer with feathers and fringe, and we need to break away from that. And part of what I do is trying to show people that the Pueblo of Acoma, where I'm from, is a totally different culture. This is another thing that just kind of inspires me to do more with what I do and be more representative of Native American culture more respectively, and really not to just try to have me represent all of Native America, saying that I am just a part of the Native American culture and there's so much more. You know, I'm just a little crack in the fashion culture, and this is just a part of what I show. There's many other designers that have other things, and we all tie our culture somehow.
Mm. So it sounds like what you're saying is that this is about the voices involved in the actual making of the art, of the design, of the expression, of the doll, whatever it might be.
Right.
It's about actual representation.
I think Spielberg did a great thing when he made the Amistad film. I remember hearing that every single person on set that were putting African actors in chains was also an African person.
Hmm.
That's a start. So you had the sensitivity to understand, that gives me chills even when I talk about it, you know. You had the sensitivity to understand that this is potentially a trauma-causing incident. Us making this film is potentially traumatic. I want to show this because it's important that I'm telling the truth about a story, or I'm trying to tell a story in the best way that I can. And I want to tell that story because that also helps society, is when we tell the story. But I'm going to be sensitive and I'm going to think about the details before I execute my telling of the story. Mm-hmm. Reaching into the community for input, you know, as Lauren said, it's a very important thing. I work in the Gila River Indian community. If there's something that I feel like I want to do in the community to help the community, I don't just go around and make decisions and go and do something. I'm consulting. You know, there's people that I know that are leaders in the community. There are elders in the community. There's council in the community. So it's not just an outside organization that is also associated with finance and money and, you know, all these other things. They're community members. If I go to the community and the elders say, no, that's not something we want, or that's not something we need, or that's disrespectful, then it's over. I walk away from the table. Yeah. So, you know, it's that simple, really. You know?
It is actually simple when you put it like that.
Yeah.
All right. Ia Afo, Lauren Aragon, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Fronteras Desk. Every year, thousands of animals are crushed trying to cross a highway just south of the U.S.-Mexico border in Sonora. It's a major impediment to jaguars, ocelots, and black bears, whose survival depends on free movement through borderlands. From the Fronteras Desk in Hermosillo, KJZZ's Kendall Blust reports on efforts to create wildlife crossings that could mitigate the dangers of the road.
Researchers stand on the edge of Mexico's Highway 2 as semis speed past. They're just outside the little town of Imuri, Sonora. Here, ocotillos, organ pipe cactus, and mesquites bright green from the summer rains line the road as it winds through the Sierra Azul Mountains. When the road clears, the researchers sprint across the cracked two-lane highway about 35 miles south of the U.S. border, then scramble down into a drainage beneath the roadway to check a camera trap tucked into the narrow tunnel.
Queremos saber cuáles son las especies que están utilizando estos drenajes.
Cecilia Aguilar is a road ecologist with the Seattle-based nonprofit Wildlands Network. She's working on a years-long project monitoring roadkill and camera traps along the highway from Imuris to Sonora's eastern border with the state of Chihuahua. She says researchers want to understand where, how, and which animals cross the highway, and if they make it. They use that information to advocate for wildlife-friendly highway crossings. Aguilar says the highway is a major barrier bisecting an important wildlife corridor through the Sky Islands in Arizona and Sonora. Endangered species like jaguars and ocelots are known to crisscross the border here.
But it won't happen if there is a border wall in between, if there's a big highway in between.
Juan Carlos Bravo is director of Western and Mexico programs for Wildlands Network. He says re-establishing jaguar and ocelot populations in the United States requires connectivity between Arizona and Sonora, and Mexico's few black bears rely on a larger population in Arizona for survival. There's been a lot of focus aimed at studying damage created by border fence construction, but Bravo says Wildlands also wants to mitigate this other barrier, the highway.
The idea is to focus mostly on underpasses.
In large part, that means reconfiguring existing drainages and putting up fencing to direct animals to safe crossings. But it will also mean constructing overpasses for larger animals less likely to cross under the road.
Black bear in the region, I think, merit that investment. The occasional jaguar that passes through, and it must be noted that most of the jaguars that have reached Arizona have actually crossed through this corridor.
Wildlands is working with transportation authorities to include wildlife crossings as part of planned highway expansions. They're also pushing for policy change. Legislation requiring wildlife crossings on Mexican highways has been introduced at both the state and federal levels. So far, only the state of Chihuahua has passed a law. Back on the highway, researchers arrive at El Aribabi Conservation Ranch to check camera traps just off the road in Sonora's Cocospera Valley. Luis Ernesto Robles and his family have owned this ranch for generations.
Sabemos que la carretera se ocupa. El problema es cómo la van a hacer.
He says highways are necessary, but they're being built in a way that causes a lot of damage here.
Se va a destruir todo. Estoy convencido de eso.
He's convinced planned expansions will destroy what's left. But researcher Ricardo Felix says new road projects can also be an opportunity for positive change.
Entonces, nosotros, al ver esa oportunidad,
money and resources budgeted for the highway expansion open up the possibility of constructing wildlife crossings too.
Al ver en las cámaras, al ver presencia de diferentes animales, pues siempre es una emoción.
He says every time the cameras snap a photo of coyotes, deer, or bobcats using drainages to cross the highway, it gives him hope that with safe passages, they'll continue to thrive in this region. Kendall Blust, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
And finally, from the science desk, here's KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis.
Warming due to climate change is driving changes in the Earth's hydrological cycle. A new study suggests changes in precipitation variability could spell bad news for trees in the American Southwest. Previous studies have shown how hotter, drier air can reduce forest growth, particularly in the Southwest. Now, a tree ring study spanning more than a century shows that moisture variability, too, can harm Southwest forests. Whereas other regions see growth during wet seasons that offsets dry season declines, trees in drier climates are unable to keep up, says co-author Erica Wise of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
The Southwest, because those trees are already so sensitive to what happens in year-to-year rain, they are the most affected by any change in the rain that's coming in.
Scientists predict moisture variability will increase under climate change. The findings appear in the journal Science Advances. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And you've been listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. We really appreciate it. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.